everybody. I'm Jennifer Cook DeRosa. I'm the host of Homeschooling for College Credit podcast. And in today's episode, we are going to talk about who these people are. Who are all of these people that work for college? And who should you talk to if you have certain questions? Of course, one department can't answer all of your questions, right? Now, this doesn't mean that you're not going to find an enthusiastic employee who might want to help. However, if you ask a question and it's from a different department, you might get the wrong answer. So we want to make sure that we're asking our questions in the right way to the right people. Colleges divide these duties up by department for a reason, okay? And that's because there are so many rules and laws and nuances that are very specific to certain situations. So you really want to focus on the expert that can provide you with the right answer. So part of that is knowing who to ask, all right? So that's what we're going to talk about today. Okay, so suppose that the person that you call answers your question as if they thought you were an enrolled college student instead of a high school dual enrolled student. Well, guess what? It's highly likely that what they told you doesn't apply to dual enrolled students. We get this all the time. We hear this when parents have questions about how dual enrollment college credit affects their student when they apply for admissions. Parents are often told incorrectly that if they accumulate too much college credit, that their student will become a transfer student. This is, of course, untrue. However, the person that's answering the question is answering the question based on general information that applies to a first-time college student who's already graduated from high school. So they're not wrong, but they don't understand the nuances of how dual enrollment credit is treated differently. And so they're not necessarily giving you the wrong information. They're just giving you the wrong information based on the details of your situation, right? So sometimes a parent will email me and they'll say, the college told me this or that. But when I ask them, well, who told you? They might not know. So of course, who could it be? It could be the janitor, right? We don't know who the college is. So it's important that you remember that who you ask always is very, very important because the different departments have different knowledge. Now, one of the first things that I'm going to say regarding all of the different people and the different people that you can ask is that it's always best to try and get this information in a written source before you ever reach out to an employee. So a college catalog is a fantastic place to find this information. You can usually access the current catalog if you go to the college's website. And college catalogs are always for an academic year. Sometimes they're for 2 years, but they're going to be dated, so you want to make sure you're in the right catalog. And that is going to be where you're going to find all of their policies. Now, everything should be in there that you're going to have a question for because your question has probably been asked 100 different times, and so it's put in the catalog for that reason. But if for some reason your question isn't in the catalog, then it's going to be important for you to go elsewhere to find that. The other thing that's important, and I mentioned written, okay, it's important that you find out the written policies for things, not just what someone tells you, because obviously taking someone's word for something is never going to be helpful. You really want to see this in writing. So a good rule of thumb or a good habit that you should get into is when you reach out to a college employee, whether it's someone who's at the desk or whether it's an appointment with an administrator or an advisor, is to always ask them to direct you to the part of the catalog that supports that answer. So if they, let's say you're asking about a CLEP policy and you want to know if the college accepts CLEP exams because your student is going to take some CLEP exams, there is going to be a written policy. There will be a list somewhere that that college is going to use to evaluate those exams. Your student is not the first person to take a CLEP exam. So there is a list. That's the list that the registrar is going to use to decide whether or not your student is going to get college credit or not. So this is not something that just happens on the spur of the moment. It doesn't vary from case to case. It's a policy and it's in writing. So as you ask these kinds of questions, instead of just taking their word for it, it's super important that you try and source where they are getting that information and try to get that in writing for your own records, because that is what is going to protect you in the event that something isn't exactly the way that it was promised. Okay, so the first category of people that you may encounter are going to be the executives. So the executives in a college or university are going to have the titles with provost, dean, president, vice president, chancellor. Now, prospective students might hear a speaker, like at a recruitment event or something like that, that has one of those titles. But in general, you're not going to have direct interaction with the executives. The enrolled students interact with executives when they have to have very serious meetings. Like, let's say there was a crime or a lawsuit, something like that. The executives are the ones running the university, and they may shake your hand at graduation, but they are not the ones that are going to be interacting with your student or with the parents on a day-to-day basis. The next group is the faculty. The faculty is another word for a teacher, and there's going to be full-time faculty and there's going to be part-time faculty. And there's a big difference in colleges and universities between the two. So full-time faculty are going to be the professors and the instructors that make up the teaching staff. Now, not everybody's a professor. Professor is a title that some colleges and universities use, and there's different variations or levels of professor. You might hear people talk about associate's professors or assistant professor or instructor. These are going to be ranks within a college or university system, and they can vary just a little bit depending on where you go. If you're unsure, it's always safe to kind of upgrade what you call someone. In other words, if you're meeting someone for the first time and you don't know their title, it's okay to say professor, even if that's higher than what they actually are. So that will be a way not to make a mistake. You wouldn't say instructor if they were a professor. They might correct you on that and be a little bit offended. So not all college teachers are professors, and not all professors teach, but the basic idea here is that these are the individuals that are going to be delivering the content for the course. So there are all types of different professors and assistant professors and things like that. Sometimes you'll hear the word tenure, and this just means that the professor has been given a lifetime employment contract. And they do this to entice professors to do a lot of research and to bring a lot of notoriety and fame to a university. So the prestigious research universities will often get a lot of media attention because they bring in people who are highly regarded in their field, and they give these professors tenure. So those professors are not often going to be the ones that are going to teach your students, you know, 100 level course, even if it's at a prestigious university. But that is what that means. That's a distinction there. Now, full-time faculty and professors, these are people who have an excellent understanding of the courses and the course sequences and the course content within their department. So if you're talking to an English professor who teaches full-time in the English department, that person is going to be able to give you lots of good information about which courses you might want to take, particularly if you're interested in English as a major later down the road. They may be counseled in terms of whether or not outside credit is going to be brought in. They may be asked to evaluate that. They are going to be able to help you find out what the textbook is for the course or other recommendations. They're also good resources, by the way, for letters of recommendation, including recommendations for scholarships or even employment. So faculty members that are full-time are going to be good resources for your student. And you may have opportunities at smaller schools. They may even supervise some of the department clubs. Like there could be like a pre-med club, and that's going to be you know, run by a faculty member, for instance. So they're going to have strong ties to the professional community. And if you have an opportunity to have your student take classes from a full-time professor, the quality of education is typically going to be a little bit better. And I know that's a generalization, and that's not speaking to them as a person or as a teacher, but if they're full-time, then they're going to have access to resources that the part-timers do not have. So part-timers inside of a college or university are called adjunct. And these are people who are 1099 employees. They're independent contractors. They work on a semester-to-semester basis. Typically, they get paid per course, and they may only have one course at the school before they move on and go to a different school. They may teach a couple courses per semester. They may do this on and off over many, many years. I did this when I was a new mom and I had lots of little kids. I taught part-time as an adjunct on and off for many, many years. But it's important to understand that the part-timer or the adjunct professor is kind of cheap labor. They're working without benefits. They don't have any type of insurance. They're not eligible for tenure. They don't have any kind of voting power. They don't really have a voice or a role outside of their teaching responsibilities. So the thing in terms of how that professor is going to be able to guide your student or provide those resources is going to be super limited. And the thing about an adjunct is sometimes they are new to teaching or they're doing it as a side hustle because they are working in their field and they may be just trying to pick up some extra money. They might be testing the waters about transitioning over to becoming a full-time teacher. It can be a number of reasons. Now, in my case, it was to actually step back from full-time. So I stopped working full-time when we started homeschooling and I went to part-time on purpose. But sometimes this is a very difficult career to break into. And so a lot of times you'll have adjuncts that will just bounce all over or they'll work at many institutions just to make ends meet. And it can be considered a stepping stone in some schools as well. The negative part about adjuncts is that unfortunately colleges will often use adjuncts to teach most of their 100 and 200 level general education courses. And so if your student has a lot of questions, if they need a lot of help, if they want to fight a policy or get special permission, or they need help navigating the college's system, maybe, you know, they need to fight a grade or something like that, it's really going to be challenging if the student is in a class from an adjunct versus if they're from a professor. So that's just something to kind of be aware of, that more and more colleges and universities are relying heavily on adjuncts to teach courses. And you may have a brand new teacher, you may have someone that's never taught before, or that is never going to teach again if they're teaching your student's class. So just be aware that it's going to be a little bit of a different situation. Then you have the administrative. Now, we're going to just talk about the five departments that you're going to interact with. There are a lot of departments that could be classified as administrative. Just depends on how the structure of the college or the university or even the state is broken down. So there's just a few that you're going to interact with. The first one is going to be admissions and enrollment. So this department's role is to enroll, okay? So think of admissions and enrollment as the sales force. They are responsible for sales, marketing, and all of the recruiting. So this is the face of the university. They're going to be the ones answering the desk question, They're going to be answering the phone. Their job is to enroll anyone who comes in the door, okay? So if they work at ABC College, they want you to attend ABC College. If they move to a different college next year and now they're at XYZ, they're going to want you to go to XYZ College. So they are going to be enthusiastic for whoever they're working for, okay? So the admissions and enrollment, here's what you should know. These are not really going to be good resources for whether or not your student should enroll at this college. Why? Because they're biased. That's their job. Okay, so a lot of the advice that they're going to give you regarding whether or not this is the right fit, it's really not the right person to ask. Okay, because it's just not going to be clear advice for your student's situation. So my advice is to not get a lot of the enrollment and admissions advice from the admissions and enrollment department, because you just aren't going to be able to get that in an honest, transparent way. Now, the next is financial aid. So financial aid is where your student is going to go to have the discussions about any type of the loans, grants, or scholarships that they're going to receive. In high school, your student is not going to be dealing with a financial aid office, because the financial aid office is for students who are already high school graduates. But when your student is in 12th grade and they start applying to colleges, then you may have some interaction with the financial aid office, particularly once they've started filling out paperwork. So the thing about financial aid office, do not ever believe that the financial aid worker is your student's financial advisor or advocate, okay? Financial aid workers are not there to give your teen advice against borrowing. They're not there to educate them about whether or not they should take a loan. They are not going to be impressed that you're trying to pay cash, okay? Their role is to process paperwork so that the institution is, of course, in compliance with many of the very strict and complex laws that govern the financial aid system. If the college makes mistakes, they can lose access to financial aid, which is a huge deal because then they can't get students to enroll, right? If they lose access to that funding, and if their students can't access Pell Grants, then they are pretty much out of business, okay? So that is a big part of what the financial aid office does. So understand that many of the snags and the frustrations that you're going to experience are not necessarily caused by the institution that you're dealing with. It could simply be a government regulation that is causing the problem. So again, I should emphasize that the financial aid office is not there to give your student guidance about borrowing, about whether or not they want to borrow. The only way that you can really help your students stay out of student loan debt is to be a very vocal and proactive guidance counselor for them, that they are not going to get that information from the financial aid officers. And again, high school students, they're not going to have this interaction. However, once they have selected their college and they have filled out their application, they for sure will start having an interaction with the financial aid department. Of course, the best way to avoid the financial aid office altogether is to just bring in so many well-planned credits, and then you can apply for scholarships and things like that so that they don't have to get those loans. Okay, then we have the bursar, also sometimes called student accounts, and this is simply the bill collector or the cashier for the college. Okay, so this is nothing more, nothing less. These are the people that are gonna send you a letter or call you when your account is past due or if it has a balance. And these are the people that will initiate the process of administratively dropping your student if they didn't pay for their course. So if there's some kind of a hold on your transcript, like they won't let you register, this is usually because you have a balance, and this is usually because the bursar or the student accounts has put that into place. So if you're paying your bills, then basically these guys are invisible to you. All right, so one last thing on that. Even if you, as the parent, are paying the bill, you'll want to make sure that your teen has a FERPA waiver so that you can see the balance. You won't be able to see their balance that they owe if you don't have a FERPA waiver on file. That information has to go directly to your student or through your student, and it goes around you. Okay, and then next we have the registrar. A lot of you guys hear me talk about the registrar all the time, because if there's any department that is the most valuable to the homeschooling for college credit community, it's the registrar, because the registrar is the top decision maker who decides whether or not your college credit that your student earned in high school is actually going to be applied to a degree. So they retain all of the academic records and the transcripts and the score reports. All of that funnels through the registrar. And so working backwards, the registrar is the one that gives that final stamp of approval when your student applies for graduation. So they are the ones that are there from start to finish through every single credit. So they are looking to make sure that those credits are all meeting all the right requirements. They will do this multiple times for your student, and they will for sure do an audit at the end when your student is ready to graduate with the degree. So they do that official degree audit, and they verify that they've met those requirements. Now, let me just give you a pro tip here. It is not uncommon for the registrar to have an error from time to time. Mistakes happen, okay? Credits get put in the wrong place. Credits get accidentally overlooked. They might get misclassified. They might get duplicated. They might get denied. So make sure that you are a second set of eyes, that you're watching this like a hawk. And you might be tempted, if they make a mistake in your favor, to let it go. Let me give you an example, right? You go to check your bank account and, oh, look, they accidentally deposited your paycheck twice. So you think this is great, but you know that they're not going to let you keep that money. They will figure that out. Well, this is also true with college credit. If you find an error, and that error, it might work either in your favor or against your favor, you still want to bring it to their attention ASAP, because they are not going to say, oh, well, it's been on your transcript for 2 years, we'll just let it slide. No, that's not what they're going to do. They're going to recalculate, and that will absolutely stop or postpone graduation. This happened to my son's very close friend last year, and he was expecting to walk at graduation. He thought he was done, and then they found that he was deficient in one class that they had told him earlier that he didn't need. So again, we're not going to listen to what they're going to tell us, right? We're going to double check and triple check. We're going to be another set of eyes. But all of those decisions happen through the registrar. And you probably won't have a lot of access to a registrar until your student is enrolled there. But that is the department that's handling it. Now, I will also say that the registrar's office might be the office that is generating the schedule of courses. Sometimes they do that. They often also maintain the college's permanent database of the course descriptions and the credits. So if you ever have to go back in time and pull an old syllabus or a course description, you might be routed to the registrar's office to do that. They are the best office to get specific college credit information from. Okay. However, you may not have access. Typically, they don't want prospective students, and particularly prospective parents, emailing or calling the registrar. There's going to be a lot of people that are kind of gatekeepers to keep you away from the registrar. They're busy doing their work, and they don't usually field questions about what credit might count 5 years from now, you know, that your student hasn't even taken yet. So ahead of enrollment, what you're going to do is you're going to use resources that are generated from the registrar's office, things like lists and charts and transfer guides and things like that. They put those together to help people kind of make decisions ahead of time. If you're looking for degree requirements, articulation agreements, transfer agreements, credit by exam policies, placement test waivers, all of these kinds of things you can usually find in the college's catalog. They have been written by the registrar, and those are provided to the public so that you can look these things up on your own. Now, of course, if you can't find the information, then you can email the registrar and see if they will give you an answer. But generally not so much. Okay, and then we have academic advising. Now, the word advisor, all right, shouldn't be confused with counselor or consultant, okay? An academic advisor is not an advocate. They're not a career coach. They're not a guidance counselor. They're not a therapist, right? The role of the academic advisor is not really as extensive as a student or a parent might expect. So the students use the advisors basically to get registered for courses. Okay, so an advisor might double check a schedule. They might look for certain sections that the student might need. But advisors can make mistakes. And I will tell you that if just because your advisor gives you advice and you follow it, still ultimately it's your responsibility to make sure that you've met your degree requirements. You want to be really careful because they can pull schedules and they can look ahead from the coming year, and they can help you plug these courses in, but ultimately all of this is still going to be on your shoulders to make sure that you're in the right class that you need for your degree, okay? An advisor will sometimes have to sign off, particularly for dual enrollment students, and there could be a lot of steps involved. There could be very few. It depends on how the dual enrollment program is set up at that college. In a perfect world, the advisor should be able to help you pick classes that are going to meet the degree requirements. Now, in the real world, this creates a lot of problems, okay? So check, double check, triple check. Advisors make mistakes, okay? Please do not leave this very important responsibility to your student, and always double check whatever the advisor is telling them. The academic advisor is not liable for any of these errors or omissions. So the student is not going to be able to go back later and say, well, my advisor told me. It's not going to fly, okay? So in short, if you take the wrong class, if you don't take enough classes, it's going to be tough luck. You're going to have to do it. So these advisors can and do make mistakes. These are just people. So it's very important that you understand it's your responsibility or your student's responsibility to make sure that they're completing all of their degree requirements. And if you're using outsourced credit, okay, for instance, you're transferring credit in, you're using a CLEP exam in place of a class, your advisor may not be up to speed on how that works. Okay, advisors are trained in the college's own courses. So if you have a lot of college credit, if you are like the Homeschooling for College Credit community where you're choosing lots of classes from lots of different colleges, you are unlikely going to be able to get good advice from an advisor about how those credits are going to work. You may need to go to the registrar for that. So that wraps up our different departments in the college that you're going to interact with. And you notice, what about the advocates? Did I talk about advocates? I didn't. Whose job is it to advocate for your teen? Well, that's you. That's your job. Colleges do not employ advocates. So hoping that someone is going to help your student make wise borrowing decisions, make wise class decisions, choose a major that is going to lead to a well-paying job, all of these things, you're not going to find them. You're not going to find them at the college. That is wasted energy. You have to be the one to help your teen to make sure that that information is front and center. And you can do that as a family. So you give them that guidance because they're not going to get that from the college. So my advice to you is to seek out advocates who have nothing to gain from your teen's decisions, particularly financial incentives. So look to your family, look to your friends, your church family, your homeschool groups, and especially your Homeschooling for College Credit Facebook groups. These are places where we can help each other, we can support each other, we can give good advice, we can provide peer review and peer support, and this is where you're going to find people who genuinely want to help. So until next time, I'm Jennifer Cook DeRosa, and you've been listening to Homeschooling for College Credit Podcast.